From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. As the House moves toward an historic impeachment vote later this week, a new NPR poll shows public support for removing the president from office remains largely unchanged. NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro joins us now in front of a very busy week coming up in Washington. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, Jeremy.
So the NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll found that Americans appear fixed in their beliefs. 48% opposes impeachment, 47% supports it. What's your takeaway?
Well, it's like our pollster said, it's like the impeachment hearings didn't even happen. You know, you've had weeks of public hearings on this, and what looks like has happened is that people's views have become reinforced rather than people having their minds open to being persuaded. And what's interesting about that is when we asked in the poll before this poll last month whether you could imagine anything that could change your mind at all, two-thirds of voters already said there was no chance that they could imagine even anything that would. And turns out that's exactly what's happened.
Okay, as we look forward to this historic vote this week in the House of Representatives on impeachment, Democrats are already losing support from at least one member. New Jersey Congressman Jeff Van Drew opposes impeachment and said he's leaving the party to become a Republican. How is this going over inside the party?
Well, it's certainly bad PR for the Democratic Party. It's certainly something that President Trump is going to use on the campaign trail, you would expect. You would also expect that there might be a couple other Democrats who wind up voting against impeachment. I think that, you know, an important recentering thing for people to realize is that Democrats won a net of 40 House seats in 2018 in what were already center-right districts. Hmm. So the Republicans who are left are already pretty much more conservative than what you had in 2018. So I think the real question is going to be some of those moderate Democrats who are saying, yes, they are going to vote for impeachment. Are they endangered in 2020 or not? They're feeling like they're not.
But there were also a handful of Republicans who won just in squeakers in the last election. Do you expect any Republicans to break with the president?
No, not at all. In fact, in our poll, we found that 91% of Republicans approve of the job that President Trump is doing. He has a 42% job approval rating, which is basically exactly where it's been for the entirety of his presidency. Yes, it's much lower or generally lower than what other presidents have had, but that consistency, if impeachment isn't going to change it, I doubt anything else really will. And these Republicans have decided that they're going to stay right in line, and you don't expect any Republicans to move. But we have had Republicans who have, you know, changed their minds. Justin Amash, for example, you know, was a Republican. Now he's switched to independent. So it's kind of like also who are the Republicans who are left?
Let's talk about the Senate trial, which would follow the House vote on impeachment maybe in January. The Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer wants four more people to testify as part of that trial, including acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney and former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Here's Schumer speaking today on Morning Edition.
These four witnesses have direct knowledge of why the aid to Ukraine was delayed. There is no reason not to have them. I haven't heard of a single good reason not to have them, other than people are afraid of what they might say.
What do you think that the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell might say to that suggestion that these four come forward?
Well, McConnell is already saying that he's working in, quote, total coordination with the White House, he said on Fox News over the weekend, which is an odd position to take. Yet usually we know kind of which way someone is going to vote. Like, we don't expect Bernie Sanders, for example, the senator from Vermont, who is an independent who caucuses with the Democrats, to vote for, you know, on President Trump's side. But he even was maintaining that facade over the weekend, saying, you know, I'll listen to all the evidence because all of the senators are jurors in this. So you would expect that that's the tact that most senators would take. That's not the tactic that Mitch McConnell is taking. He's saying he hopes that not a single Republican votes for impeachment. You have Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina also saying that he's going to say, go out there and say he's not unbiased. He's not going to vote in favor of this. And in fact, doesn't want any witnesses called because he doesn't want to add anything on top of what's already been presented in the House.
Quickly, Domenico, this NPR poll that we talked about also had some stuff about the 2020 race. It shows Joe Biden in the lead nationally, Bernie Sanders number two. What else does it tell you about the state of the race?
Well, you have Elizabeth Warren in third at 17% of South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg fourth with 13%. There's a pretty clear top tier. Andrew Yang is back further with 5%. And the coalitions are really what's interesting. Biden leads with older, moderate voters, women without a college degree, and voters in the South. Sanders with young voters, progressives, and narrowly with voters of color. Mm-hmm. And Buttigieg with college-educated whites and Warren fighting two fronts there.
And a debate coming up on Thursday. NPR Senior Absolutely. Political Editor and Correspondent Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
Thank you.
Economists are taking a closer look at the U.S. and China's Phase One trade deal that was announced last Friday. The Trump administration has been touting one big talking point, that the Chinese agreed to pay $50 billion worth of U.S. farm products. Some experts say that's unrealistic. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. And Jill, remind us exactly what is in this deal.
You know, I think the most important part of this phase is what did not happen. Mm-hmm. And that is that the United States agreed to hold off on the imposition of 15% tariffs on $156 billion worth of Chinese goods. That was supposed to take place yesterday. And why is that so important? Because that round would be including a ton of stuff that we buy every day. Consumer goods like electronics, tablets, your iPhones, clothing and boots and everything else that you would want to think about coming into the new year. So we're really happy that didn't happen. The next part of the deal itself is that there would be a reduction in the tariff rate on $120 billion of goods to 7.5%. That was down from 15%. Now, that still leaves 25% tariffs on another $250 billion worth of Chinese goods. And in exchange, China agreed to increase its purchase of American food, energy, manufactured goods, and services by about $200 billion over the next couple of years. That would include a commitment to increase agricultural product purchases from the current level, about $8 billion, to up to $40 to $50 billion.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about that $50 billion number in farm products. How realistic is that figure, really?
Well, it's really interesting because I think it was heralded immediately like, oh, that's great. But then on Friday, as the deal was being announced, Chinese officials didn't answer the question of the exact size of this commitment. And, you know, during the negotiations, the Chinese had insisted that these purchases would be based on market forces. So the actual number, this would require a huge jump in China's imports, be about double where we were back in 2017. And so some people are thinking that that could mean that China couldn't even have the capacity to absorb those increases. Mm. So they're doubting these numbers.
You mentioned what didn't happen. A lot of critics are analyzing this phase one deal. There was one that basically said, however Trump may try to spin this, he lost. How so?
Well, this is the great tweet over the weekend from Paul Krugman. He's an economist and a New York Times columnist, and it got a lot of attention because essentially what Krugman is saying is that if these specific target purchase amounts don't occur, then his argument is that we mostly end up where we started, with the Chinese buying some agricultural products. They sell us increasingly sophisticated manufacturing goods. And along the way, unfortunately, the farming and the manufacturing industry suffer. So did overall business confidence. And Krugman is certainly putting an underscore under the last part of that, which is, look, we have to get more out of this to consider it a success.
Yeah, it's not just Krugman. There are lots of others that are saying basically that China has been able to preserve its discriminatory industrial policies at the expense of China's trading partners and the global economy. That was a China expert, Scott Kennedy, at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Is that the consensus, that China basically is going to come out of this fairly unscathed?
Well, I don't think unscathed, because the Chinese economy has taken a hit. But that said, part of the announcement of the deal is that the Chinese are going to make some sort of reforms and changes to their regime in the areas of intellectual property, technology transfer, and the ability for U.S. financial service firms to come in and tap the Chinese consumers and get into their financial services industry. Unfortunately, again, no details about this. And I think that's where skepticism starts to arise, which is, unless we have the details of exactly what's going to happen, and it's going to be written into Chinese law. See, that's key. Mm. To have them say, yes, we'll do it, without there being any backup or accountability, means we're back in the soup again if they don't come through.
And we're also seeing this new Chinese economic data out today that is a little better than what economists were expecting. Industrial output and consumer spending were all up, suggesting that China may actually hit its 6% growth rate next year. After all, how trustworthy are these numbers?
I don't know anybody who studies the Chinese economy that accepts the Chinese numbers per se. But that said, here's what we know. China's economy took a hit this year, for sure. Then the Chinese government enacted a number of policies to try to lift economic activity. That appears to be working. We are seeing an uptick in factory production and consumer spending. So I don't know exactly if the 6% number is going to be correct or not. But what we do know is that it may be the Chinese economy bottomed out in October. Of course, all this could go away if these trade war tensions get back up on the front burner from the back burner come 2020. Yeah.
That's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
The night before his first scene with Catherine O'Hara, Dan Levy was a little freaked out.
This is my first time acting since a Lifetime movie that I did with Misha Barton.
The stories behind the celebrities. Every Tuesday on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
It's been 400 years since the beginning of the transatlantic slave trade. To mark this, the president of Ghana is welcoming descendants of those enslaved back home. It's called the Year of Return. Here he is announcing it in September of 2018.
We will work together to make sure that never again will we allow a handful of people with superior technology to walk into Africa, seize our peoples, and sell them into slavery.
The goal is to learn more about the history of Ghana and invest in the country. It's expected to draw about 500,000 visitors from here in the U.S. and around the world. One of those returning is actor Boris Kodjo, currently known for his role as Captain Sullivan on the ABC show Station 19. And Boris is playing a seminal role in helping Ghana's president attract the diaspora in America to Ghana. Boris, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. This is exciting.
Yes. So you and your wife, actress Nicole Ari Parker, spearheaded this initiative back in 2018, mm-hmm. named it Full Circle Festival. The first trip, there were just seven people?
Well, the first trip was just one of our family vacations that we went on with my children and another friend of ours, Bozoma St. John. And we had a meeting with the president, and he asked us to host an event celebrating collective ancestry and commemorating the 400 years of the beginning of the slave trade. So then
the following year
was year one of Full Circle, which was last December. And we brought about 100 people, chiefs of industry, influencers, you know, celebrities from entertainment, sports.
And this year you're expecting about 500 people to come with you?
Yes, it's been pretty crazy because in 2018, Ghana issued 70,000 visas for the country. And this year, it's 700,000.
So, wow. And when you talk about the visas, you're talking about this special program specifically to welcome those from America back home to Ghana, so to speak.
Yeah, it's an initiative by the President Akufo Addo to empower members of the diaspora to reconnect with the ancestry and, you know, come back and see for themselves, you know, the culture, because it's so important for our collective identity, for our self-worth, our confidence, to know where we came from.
It's obvious that you're so passionate about this. Your background, so your father is from Ghana, mm-hmm. correct? Tell us just a little bit more.
Yeah, my dad, he passed 3 years ago. He was born and raised in Accra in Ghana and got a scholarship to come to Europe to study medicine. And that's where he met my mom in Germany. My mother's German. And so me and my siblings were born in Austria and in Germany. And growing up, I remember us going back to Ghana a lot. And even after my parents divorced, it was important for my mother to make sure that we stay connected. Now that I have children, I find it tremendously important to make sure that you teach your children about their heritage. My kids speak German, and they've been to Ghana many times, and they're looking forward to going back. And it's tremendously important to empower your children to understand their roots and their ancestry.
Talk a little bit more about that. Why is that important to you?
I mean, if you look at the issues that we're battling here in this country, they're all rooted in the fact that we oftentimes feel inferior. We oftentimes suffer from a lack of identity. And that, unfortunately, is one of the negative legacies of the slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are to develop a sense of belonging in this country, we have to go back and understand that we didn't come from South Carolina. We didn't come from Alabama. We didn't come from Mississippi. No, we came from the West Coast of Africa, mostly. We came from kings and queens, and that we're not descendants of slaves, but yet descendants of enslaved Africans. We're descendants of the survivors.
Yeah, and that distinction is important.
It's a huge, hugely important distinction.
One other thing you've said is that double consciousness goes out the window the moment you step foot in Ghana. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, first of all, for people who don't understand what double consciousness means, it's the constant awareness, not just of who you are, but also how other people perceive you. And for Black people in this country, it's something that we have grown up with. There's always a sense that people around us are perceiving us as different. And that goes away when you go back to Africa, because everybody's the same.
Mm.
And the levity you experience is transformational.
Yeah, I've heard you say that this is a movement, and you likened this trip to a Jewish pilgrimage to Israel. Do you believe that all Black people should take this trek, even if they don't invest necessarily in Ghana or decide to move there permanently?
Oh, absolutely. This is purely to explore your roots and to find out who you are. And it's really about building a bridge between a diaspora and the continent. And we are all the resources we need. Africa doesn't need aid. Africa needs to galvanize the diaspora to invest in all these things that are necessary for Africa to take its rightful place on the planet.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. We know several countries, including China, are heavily investing. China has heavily invested in mining natural resources. But you've said before that Africans are the ones to develop Africa, and you really feel strongly about that. What does economic investment look like to you?
Well, first of all, in terms of natural resources, Africa is the richest continent in the world. That's why all these, you know, colonizers and nations like China are heavily interested and invested in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to go back to 1884. That's when the then Chancellor of Germany, Bismarck, called on his friend, King Leopold from Belgium, and they decided to hold a conference in Berlin to colonize and exploit the continent. King Leopold went into the Congo, killed 15 million people. After World War II, 1958, when the French decided to grant independence to the 14 French colonies, they decided to make them sign the pact for the continuation of colonization, which was a contract that required those nations to continue to pay what they call the colonial debt to France, which stands until today.
Yeah. And about what does the French debt look like? Can you just give us like
the debt idea? Is $500 billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
So the first step of creating economic development was the African Free Trade Agreement that was just established. The next step is to bring members of the diaspora over, establishing a presence on the continent so that when those contracts become available, there's somebody at the table who can put in a bid.
This, of course, is a three-prong effort, as you said. Though I'm thinking about the pilgrimage to Ghana, this isn't the first time we've seen this in history. We know Malcolm X has gone there, MLK, W.E.B. Du Bois moved there and even was buried there. Right now, there seems to be a lot of enthusiasm from Black Americans to reconnect with their African roots. How do you see this staying alive? Do you think that this time around is different from all of the other times that we've seen in history where our people have made that trek and really tried to bring people along with them?
Yeah, I think what has helped us in the effort was within the first 3 days, we generated over 100 million impressions by way of our guests starting to post pictures and telling stories and sharing their experience with the world. It was authentic and real. Mm-hmm. And then CNN did a report about Full Circle Festival and how we moved Ghana from 89th place to number 4 in the world of most desirable tourist destination.
Wait, just by this pilgrimage?
Yeah. Just by the noise that Full Circle Festival made. And we got calls from 26 other nations within weeks after Full Circle Festival.
Are there plans to expand this?
Absolutely. You know, part of what's been plaguing Africa is the lies that have been told about the continent for decades.
I mean, really, when you talk to people here in the United States, many people, it's like a black hole.
Well, it's a black hole. First of all, it's one country.
Yeah.
Also, people don't know how big Africa is.
Right.
Right. And then all the other myths, you know, it's a cesspool. There's diseases, there's wars everywhere, terrorism. And by all these people from the diaspora going over there, we have effectively started changing that narrative. And I think it's important that we go over there, first of all, when we're invited, and go over there with the readiness to be taught and be educated.
10 years from now, what is your wildest dream for this project?
Oh, wow. 10 years from now, I want Africa to be the number one destination for members of the diaspora. I want a tremendous amount of African investment and empower all people of African descent to be united to not just, you know, better Africa, but better ourselves in the process, because we can only be whole as an individual if Africa is whole as a continent.
Boris Kodjoe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's actor Boris Kodjoe talking about the year of return.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
Most lawmakers try to stay in touch with their constituents to find out what's on their minds. Some hold town hall meetings or informal coffees. Others hold public events that are heavily orchestrated. Others rarely hold public events at all. One Republican state lawmaker from upstate New York is taking the informal meet and greet to another level. Monica Sandreski of North Country Public Radio reports.
About 20 people gather around a bonfire by the Indian River in the village of Antwerp in northern New York. One of Assemblyman Mark Walczyk's staffers adds another log to the fire.
Gosh, where's our poker stick?
People set up lawn chairs, there are donuts and fixings for s'mores. Barbara and Bruce Mitchell are chatting and trying to stay warm. Bruce works as the town zoning officer and plays Santa Claus at Christmas time. He jokes he wishes they were drinking something harder than apple cider.
I am surprised there ain't no beer, because you can't have a fire without beer in Antwerp.
You can probably tell this is a pretty casual event. Assemblyman Walczyk actually built the fire himself. He says it's important for him to get out of the state capitol.
You tend to end up in a bubble if you're only listening to the interest groups and the squeaky wheels that are barking at you all the time, sending you emails, stopping by your office. Pretty easy as a representative to forget the people that you represent, and the bulk of them you got to go out and listen to. So if you're not having events that they feel comfortable walking up to, then you're going to lose that voice.
One of those voices is George Turner. He's wearing a navy blue hoodie from his volunteer fire department. He says they need money to build bigger truck bays.
We've done a lot of work inside the building to keep the building going and keep it up to code. It's just that the gear and everything is getting expensive, and we can't tax the taxpayers only so much.
Walzik assures Turner he'll talk with the village government and see what can be done. Here, around the campfire, Walzik doesn't get up to give a speech or do anything formal. He just talks one-on-one with folks. This relaxed setting is exactly why Tim Tanner showed up tonight. A bonfire is much more his speed than traditional Q&As at a town hall meeting, which make him nervous.
So if you get up to a microphone, you better have your stuff together. You're going to look like a knucklehead and come out and be embarrassed. Here, you don't have to worry about it. It's just talking back and forth.
Okay, so...
Tanner's daughter, Jennifer McConnell, sits in the lawn chair by Assemblyman Walzik. McConnell tells him she's frustrated because her family can't get internet at their house.
But yeah, I think it's pretty bad.
Yeah. There's been a few waves of rural broadband initiatives. I would be very curious to see where your road is on the map.
I honestly think they missed our road, to be truthful. Yeah. I do.
Walzik promises McConnell that he'll look into it and follow up.
All right, you ready? What's your phone number?
315.
But then McConnell and Walzik joke around for a few minutes. Two people around a campfire talking about disliking s'mores because they're sticky. Where a town hall meeting can be divisive, even hostile, McConnell says bonfires bring people together to remember we're all neighbors who may need a little help from their local politician. For Here and Now, I'm Monica Sandreski.
In the United States of 2019, it's all about growth. Many think that if you're not growing, you're dying. That goes for companies. It also goes for cities and towns. The problem is that thousands of cities and towns are losing residents. And so some researchers in the Midwest are trying to figure out how these places can shrink in a smart way. David Peters is an associate professor of sociology at Iowa State University, and Kimberly Zarikor is professor of architecture there. They're part of a team of researchers that has studied this idea in a project funded by the National Science Foundation. They join me now from Ames, Iowa. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Well, and first of all, why don't you just define the term for me, shrinking smart? What does that mean exactly?
Well, shrinking smart is where we look at communities that have had faster than average declines in population, but conversely, faster than average gains in quality of life. So the typical thinking of shrink smart is that you have faster gains but growing quality of life.
Okay, so let's start with why these places are shrinking in the first place. What are the main reasons?
Well, the main reasons are like much of the Corn Belt, the Great Plains in the Midwest, is that the main cause of shrinkage is outmigration due to decline in traditional rural industries due to global trade, automation, and consolidation in both the industrial sector and the ag sector. And so Kimberly can talk more on this, but shrinking places were built to serve a late 19th to 20th century economic system that doesn't exist. And, of course, agriculture, mining, forestry, and manufacturing operate quite differently in the 21st century. So the economic purpose of a lot of these small towns is disappearing, and the people along with it as they migrate to larger cities for jobs and other amenities.
So how do you make the quality of life go up when, let's say, the industry goes away?
So some of the things that we have found are working in these communities are building social capital. And what we mean when we say social capital are the connections between people, the relationships in town, building up a leadership group that includes multi-generational leaders. We see a lot of private philanthropy in these communities. These are people who live there and locally who are giving money specifically to programs in the community. And what we found is altogether this is creating a new kind of social network that makes people feel very connected to the place. They want to be there with their family, but also their friends and their neighbors, and they're interested in the future of the town. And one of our great predictors of smart shrinkage are when you ask people if they're optimistic about the future in their town, they tell you that they are.
But in order to be truly optimistic about the future in their town, wouldn't they have to think about growing again?
Yeah, see, that's what makes this project unique is that we've sort of refrained from pushing the growth narrative that really people should accept that their towns are shrinking because there's not much they can do about it. And so when communities invest in themselves, they develop this entrepreneurial social infrastructure that helps them overcome any kinds of challenges, provide good quality services, strong social capital, a strong evidence of philanthropy. that helps them address community issues.
So you looked at 99 towns across Iowa that had populations between 500 and 10,000 people. Give me an example of one that is shrinking smart and one that's not.
So one of the towns that we studied that we're very interested to learn from is a town called Elma, which is out in northeast Iowa. And this is a town of between 600 and 700 people. And over the last 25 years, they've managed to stabilize their population. And they are known in their region as a place where there's lots to do, many activities. They have social events all the time. They have a small tourist economy. They're connected to social media. They have a wonderful Facebook page. Many times a day, they're posting events and all sorts of information. And they're very connected to the place. And now young families are staying, and their population actually is very slowly but a little bit increasing. And this is part of our research to try to understand whether or not over the long term that these stabilization strategies will eventually lead to enough stabilization that you see a tiny uptick in population.
Hmm.
We're seeing some towns south of Des Moines in central South Iowa where the community is really led by an elite group of people who are not welcoming to new voices in leadership, that have discouraged new ideas, experimentation with new kinds of events. And people in the town are not optimistic because they don't feel that there's space being made for them, and they don't feel that diverse opinions or any kind of new projects or ideas that might improve the town, they don't think that they're accepted by this elite that for the long term has been in control. So these are some of the problems that we see in the towns that are not doing well.
And do you think that what you're finding would apply to towns outside of Iowa across the country?
Yeah, we believe so. I mean, particularly towns in the Midwest and the Great Plains where shrinkage is most severe, we think that the findings in Iowa would apply generally to agricultural and manufacturing towns in that area. It probably isn't going to apply too much to towns in the West where they have a high degree of natural amenities and there's a lot of federal land, but definitely in the worst shrinking areas in the Midwest and Great Plains and to a lesser extent towards the Great Lakes states into Ohio and western Pennsylvania, we think that these strategies would apply quite well.
Well, and if there is a city manager or a mayor who's listening to this somewhere and they're thinking, well, my town is starting to shrink too, what would be the one or two policy ideas you would give them?
So we would say a couple things. One, get residents to give more of their time and more of their money to local projects, get people involved in local organizations, allow new people to take leadership roles, support new leaders in pursuing new ideas and accept that failure will occur, but keep trying whatever you do. Network with groups outside of your community to get new ideas and know-how. And we think, finally, remember that demographics is not equal quality of life, that your town can still be thriving, a thriving community despite population loss.
Yeah, and I think one of the most important messages we want to send is that the growth narrative, that only growth is positive, that this is something that we think some towns have to get past because the trends show that it's simply not going to happen. So the question is what to do when you're in a town that's shrinking. We want you to have some choices and some energy and optimism and not only focus on the population numbers.
Now, David, you are an associate professor of sociology, and Kimberly, you're a professor of architecture. Why take in the ideas of these different disciplines and different areas of study to try to learn about how a city should shrink smart?
Well, this project emerged from my personal research in Eastern Europe. I'm actually a historian of communist architecture in Czechoslovakia, which sounds funny, but one of the towns that I've spent a lot of time in is a shrink smart community in the Czech Republic. And I wanted to try to apply this shrink smart concept in small Iowa communities, and we couldn't find any research that was trying to think about rural smart shrinkage.
Mm-hmm.
So I gathered the team together. I brought David in, who works with the Iowa Small Town Poll and is really an expert in rural quality of life. And I also brought in colleagues from community and regional planning, another architect, and also a data scientist, because we were interested in understanding how data science might contribute to the research.
And David, what do you think you bring to this as a sociologist?
Yeah, I'm actually a rural sociologist by training. So it's a subfield of sociology that studies rural communities and farmers. And so rural sociologists tend to think of decline as something inevitable and that there's not much one can do about this. But the shrink smart concept is unique in the sense that it's more about maintaining these essential services. And that's something – that my discipline hasn't focused on as much. We document aspects of decline, causes of decline, but really don't say much about what can these towns actually do to maintain essential services. So I think that's a very good cross-fertilization of the two areas.
Is there a role, do you think, for the state and federal government when it comes to helping cities and towns shrink in a smart way?
Yeah, I would say there is, in mainly providing grant funds and matching funds to community foundations. One thing we did find in our work is that most projects were led by community groups, not by government. And there was a number of reasons for that. But the primary one is a lot of federal dollars and state dollars come with strings attached. And oftentimes it's the priorities of the state and federal government, not the priorities of the community. So I would say a role for the state is to offer either matching funds with few restrictions and allow communities to identify those needs, but have government be a helper, but not a leader of those projects.
Well, it's a very interesting thing to study. I'm sure that our listeners have a lot of questions. They can ask them at hereandnow.org. And I will say that as a Seinfeld fan, it gives a whole new meaning to the word shrinkage, which people can Google if they don't know. David Peters, Associate Professor of Sociology at Iowa State University, and Kimberly Zarikor, Professor of Architecture. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Loopholes allowed six of the biggest Silicon Valley companies to avoid paying more than $100 billion in taxes since 2010. That's according to analysis by the British group Fair Taxmark. Paul Monahan is CEO of that group, and he joins us now from Manchester in the UK. Welcome.
Hello.
So you looked at a group you call the Silicon Six, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google, and Microsoft, and compared their internal accounting of the tax they owed between 2010 and 2019 to the amount they actually paid. And tell us what you found.
We found an enormous tax gap. So if we look at the cash flow statement, actual cash paid to the US government and other governments around the world, and we compared it to two other things. The current tax provision in the accounts. So this is the number that the media normally report when they say how much income, how much profit, how much tax paid. And the gap between the cash taxes handed over the decade and the amount provided for on the report and accounts was this enormous $100 billion. There was actually even larger number of $155 billion, which is the gap between the cash taxes paid and handed over and the headline rate of tax in the United States, which is about 35% for most of the decade.
How are these companies avoiding paying these taxes?
Well, what we're seeing is a multitude of strategies, but one of the most prevalent is the shifting of income and profit to low tax or zero tax jurisdictions. So what that might look like in practice is I'm sitting in the UK and I want to buy Microsoft Office and I want to buy LinkedIn, two Microsoft products. But when I get my invoice, my bill, the bill is from Ireland. And the reason the bill's coming from Ireland and not within the UK is because the corporation tax in Ireland is so much lower that they want to book the income and the profits there from where it is then shifted onward to other jurisdictions to reduce the amount of tax paid further.
Okay, so I know that many folks who are listening to this, as they're listening to you explain this all, they're probably seething and they're thinking, is anything you uncovered here illegal?
We are not talking here tax evasion, whereas somebody knowingly breaks both the letter and the spirit of the law. Tax avoidance is when somebody sticks to the letter of the law but breaches the spirit of the law. And what we see here is companies engineering artificial and aggressive systems to reduce the tax contribution to the societies in which they trade and actually rely.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about some of the other things you found. You found that some of these companies paid less than others. Amazon, for example, has paid just $3.4 billion in income taxes this decade, while Apple paid more than $93 billion. Why did some pay so much more than others, and why in particular is Amazon's ultimate tax bill so low?
So the Amazon and Facebook stood out as having the lowest cash taxes paid of any of the businesses, between 10 and 12%. And Microsoft and Apple were at the other end, still low, but not as low, between 16 and 17%. Amazon seem to actively do everything they can to not declare a profit in the first instance. One of the reasons they do that is they are not trying to pay dividends to shareholders or engage in equity buyback, whereas the likes of Microsoft and Apple want to pay dividends to shareholders. Therefore, it's necessary to declare profits in order to do that.
Okay, Amazon disputes your conclusions, and they say it's actually unfair to compare them to these other Silicon Valley companies. In a statement to CNBC, one of their spokespeople said, governments write the tax laws, and Amazon is doing the very thing they encourage companies to do, paying all taxes due while also investing many billions in creating jobs and infrastructure. What's your response to that?
I think three things I'd respond. The first one is Amazon is spinning a line with journalists all over the world right now, which is that they're simply a low-margin retailer, which neglects the fact that their most recent annual report showed that Amazon Web Services, the cloud computing division, is by far their biggest contributor now. Secondly, they like to focus on what they called the effective tax rate. This isn't money that's actually paid. These are just provisions made in the report and accounts that may or may not be paid at some point in the future. The actual cash taxes handed over are much lower. And then the third point would be Amazon and all of the others regularly say, oh, whatever the rules are, we'll stick to them. You change the rules, we'll stick to the new rules, whilst actively lobbying to make sure that the rules are not changed. And if they are going to be changed, they favour them even further. We're talking millions upon millions of dollars every year spent by these businesses to water down and create the loopholes that they can then exploit further down the line.
What really is the impact overall to this corporate tax avoidance? Why does it matter?
It matters for two reasons in particular. The first is just the plain unfairness of one business competing against another and one having such an enormous competitive advantage because it doesn't pay taxes. And the second issue is just the enormous shortage that this creates in terms of public funding. And we've just got to remember, these businesses, their staff are trained in schools. Their staff use roads. They rely on society to operate. They need to make a fair contribution to the societies in which they actively generate their wealth.
That's Paul Monahan. He is CEO of Fair Tax Mark. Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tanya. That was great.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
I'm Tanya Mosley. After several anti-abortion laws were passed around the country, Republicans in Ohio are now taking things further, proposing a bill that would make it a felony to purposely perform or have an abortion. A sponsor says the goal is to end abortion in its entirety. That's next time on Here and Now.